Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Schedule F, the Trump-era civil service innovation, not the tax form. It's like a zombie. It's dead, having been canceled by the Biden administration, but it still seems animated, judging from the range of activities devoted to keeping it entombed. For more, Federal Drive host Tom Temin spoke with the policy counsel at the Project on Government Oversight, Joe Spielberger.
Schedule F refers to an executive order that former President Trump signed near the very end of his presidency. It would have created a new category of federal worker that basically would have existed outside of the regular laws and regulations governing the rights and protections that most federal employees have. And basically, it would have been... it would have just made it easier for a president or a political appointee to fire employees for almost any reason.
But it was for the accepted service, not the regular civil service, correct?
Right, exactly. It would have created this new category in the accepted service. And so it would have allowed agencies to unilaterally transfer employees from the competitive service to this new category or from other accepted service categories into Schedule F as well.
Right. So, for example, a senior executive program manager, a career person, could potentially, under Schedule F, be moved into Schedule F. And the presumption is that the administration at the moment didn't like the way that program was being run or felt that its policy was being thwarted by that person.
Exactly. And while the executive order only started to become implemented, it was estimated that the number of employees who would have been impacted under Schedule F would have totaled in the tens of thousands, up to 50,000, even 100,000 or more. And so just to put that number in a little bit of context, normally there are roughly 4,000 political appointees. So just by those estimates alone, it would have exponentially increased the number of political appointees by 10, 20, or even more.
And it would have had the potential, again, to emphasize that point of arbitrarily converting some people that were already in competitive service to non-competitive or the Schedule F type of thing. So that means, given that potential number of 100,000, that goes way beyond the senior executive service, which is only about 9,000.
Exactly. And then, you know, if you talk to some of the pro-Schedule F proponents, you know, they will argue that it wouldn't be necessary to transfer that number of employees. But what's important is that they are very clear about using this as a chilling example, you know, firing a few employees at first to set an example and then just establishing this really culture of fear and intimidation in agencies across the federal government.
And now the status of Schedule F is that I think that was one of the first things that the Biden administration did away with, correct?
That's right. Yes. President Biden rescinded the executive order upon taking office. Of course, now, as we've seen through the current presidential race, you know, Schedule F has really gotten the consensus of much of the Republican Party. And so Ross Vaught, for instance, the former OPM head, who's now playing a key role in the Heritage Foundation and their Project 2025, has said that it's unlikely that any future Republican president would fail to implement Schedule F. And so regardless of what happens in this upcoming election, this is an issue that certainly is not going away anytime soon.
In the meantime, though, besides the repealing that happened early by the Biden team, there's also an OPM rule, correct, that bans it, so to speak?
Yes. Yeah, so OPM recently finalized a new rule to strengthen protections for civil servants. It does a few really important things. First, it clarifies that employees would retain the same adverse action protections when they are transferred into this type of category. It also clarifies the loophole that President Trump exploited by further defining that when we talk about these confidential policy determining, policy making, or policy advocating employees, that really refers to employees who are non-career political appointees. And then the third main thing that it does it also outlines a new process that agencies would have to follow to transfer and initiate new hiring actions. And so this is a really important roadblock. It's not the end all be all. You know, we still need legislation to fully prevent a more politicized civil service. But this is an important next step in strengthening these protections for civil servants.
We're speaking with Joe Spielberger, policy counsel at the Project on Government Oversight. Yes, there's a rule from OPM, but of course, let's face it, OPM has directors that are appointed by administration. So OPM itself moves back and forth policy-wise with respect to who's in power. So the rule then is a little bit stronger maybe than the executive order, but rules can be reruled also. What is the prospect for legislation here? There is something that comes up from time to time in Congress.
There is. There's been legislation the past couple of years in the House sponsored by Representative Jerry Connolly. And then there's a Senate companion bill sponsored by Senator Tim Kaine. POGO and other good governance advocates have lobbied strongly for that. We understand the political dynamics make it really unlikely to see that bill moving this Congress. So we're continuing to have conversations both on the Hill and in executive branch agencies to see what other defensive mechanisms we can enact this Congress.
What has POGO been doing on this, and what type of work have you done?
So POGO is, again, continuing all of these conversations with lawmakers, with advocates. And the main thing that we're trying to do right now is really make it clear that when we talk about Schedule F and threats to civil servants, we are not just talking about the impact on federal employees themselves, but we're really talking about the harms to communities and the rights and benefits and services that we all rely on and many of us take for granted that would be under threat under a more politicized civil service. And so especially looking towards this upcoming presidential election, we want to make sure that voters across the country and advocates and lawmakers are really keeping this issue front and center in their minds so that they're aware of the threats that await us.
Well, what threats, what policy or benefit to the community, to a community, could be threatened by this?
So there are so many different, of course, critical roles that impact us in our day-to-day lives. I think a really good example is disaster relief. If your home is threatened by a hurricane or a natural disaster, your community is at risk. You want to make sure that federal relief arrives safely and timely and effectively, regardless of where you live, how your state voted in the previous presidential election. You know, we always see accusations of political gamesmanship when it comes to providing disaster relief, things like Social Security benefits. If you apply for Social Security and other government benefits, you need to be able to trust that the people processing and delivering those benefits, you know, are in those positions because of their qualifications and not because of their political ideology. And so at the end of the day, everyone deserves a federal government that treats them fairly and effectively, regardless of who they are, where they live, or how they vote.
And is the potential, though, for the Schedule F to run in two directions? That is to say, if a Democratic administration had it, the same ill effects could happen as if a new Trump administration or something had Schedule F.
Absolutely. This is a really bad policy, regardless of whether there's a Republican in the White House or a Democrat in the White House. And again, there's a reason why we rely on these nonpartisan civil servants to provide these protections and services that we all rely on and make sure that those services and benefits are being provided fairly and effectively.
That's Joe Spielberger, policy counsel at the Project on Government Oversight, speaking with Federal Drive host Tom Temin. We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.